Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, what's the best example of a successful follow-up to a really big album?
Easy. That would be 1997's If Only for the Hatchery.
There you go.
That's gold. All right. Jerry.
Patrick, we're recording again remotely. I think this is going to be the default for, looks like, you know, some time. And we're at least, while we're under these circumstances, trying to use the time wisely and check in with some listeners of the podcast and see how they're doing. And especially the, you know, the patrons of the show, they are folks who get to pick the topic anyway. So seems like a good opportunity to do those episodes right now, right?
Yeah, totally. Makes a lot of sense to me. And it's great to connect with people. As we were chatting before we returned the recorders on, it's just great to connect and see faces of people like you and our guest today, and just really, you know, make you feel a little more human in a time when we don't feel very normal. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the beauties of modern technology is that we can keep this going and we can connect like this, and you know, it I think it helps us all out in some small or potentially big way, I think, even.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
So here we go. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster,
and today we're gonna have on Mike Wagner from Houston. Hello, Mike.
Hello, gents. Always good to talk to you.
Hey, Mike.
Mike will get to pick the topic here and he'll set us up in a minute, but before we do that, just, you know, how are you hanging on under the circumstances? How are you and your family?
We are good. We're hunkered down and in for the duration. Looks like they're going to shut Houston down in a couple weeks, like New York and D.C. New York and California are.
L.A.
So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy times. Crazy times.
By the time this goes out, it'll probably seem like, wait, what?
I know. Yeah, again, to the listeners, there's only a week or two delay between when we record and when we post it. So, but music helps us through difficult times, and people have, you know, extra time now to listen to music, and hopefully it's providing some comfort. And I think that sort of plays into the topic you wanted to discuss, right, Mike?
Yeah, I thought the good topic would be... A lot of bands have these monster albums, right? These huge albums that just take off. And the problem is the follow-up album a lot of times can be a disappointing effort, because for many, many reasons, because bands get worn out by it, or they're on the road forever, and success comes with its own set of problems that they hadn't dealt with before. But sometimes after an album, an artist will actually do a very, very good album, but it will be overshadowed by the one that's previous. So I thought, let's look at some of those albums and just talk about them and things that we like about them. And I just thought it might be an interesting topic.
I think that's a great topic.
Very cool.
And I think you're right. I think a lot of artists either go one of two ways when they are following up what ended up being a huge hit album. They either try to replicate that, or just, you know, keep giving people more of that thing they obviously liked. Or they're like, I can't possibly top what I just did there, so I'm going to go in a different direction for the next album. And sometimes you'll see maybe they'll go and do something that's quieter or more introspective. If it was like a big hit, you know, a big hit rock album, I'm thinking of, like, you know, kind of Springsteen will kind of do that, go in and out of different styles, right? Because he doesn't always just want to follow up the thing that was a big hit. So, like, Born in the USA was the biggest hit, and then he did Tunnel of Love, which was a really different type of record, right?
And actually, that was one of the ones I had on my list, and I think it's an outstanding album, right? That's actually, I mean, Bruce Springsteen is fine, and some people love him. I'm just okay on him, but I've always thought Tunnel of Love was one of his best. For me personally, I mean, everyone has their favorites, but I thought Tunnel of Love was one of his best albums, especially the title song itself.
I think it's a great album too, and it, but it hits you in a different way, right? And so I think the people who appreciate it get something a little bit. It's a different experience, so I think the people who appreciate it get something different out of it than they got out of Born in the USA.
Correct.
Funny thing about Springsteen too is he kind of had two swings at this, right? So Born in the Run was, of course, his big breakthrough album, and he. Followed that up with Darkness on the Edge of Town, which is really kind of a similar record in a lot of ways, you know? And then with Born in the USA, as we just discussed, he followed that one up with something that was like much different.
Yeah.
So what are some of the examples you have, Mike? What are some of the records you want to talk about?
Well, I thought one of the first ones we would talk about, because I know Patrick likes a certain artist quite a lot. Obviously, Rumors was a massive, massive hit.
Yes, it was.
But actually, I've always liked Tusk, which followed up Rumors, which Fleetwood Mac took a lot of grief for. And I think Tusk is a masterpiece of an album. And it's when people ask me my favorite albums of all time, Tusk is actually in that list for me personally. Obviously, Sarah is just an immaculate song. And as you know, as I like production work, and I love the way Lindsey Buckingham produces an album, and it, Sarah, just sounds beautiful.
Wait a minute, baby. Stay with me a while. Said you give me life, but you never told me about the fire.
Couldn't agree more with that. And, you know, it's an interesting in the case of Tusk. I think what you said was such a great observation, Mike, when you said it comes with a whole set of problems, you know, that never existed before when you have one of these massive albums, both in terms of popularity and you know, maybe you're playing giant places as, you know, as opposed to maybe you were playing medium-sized places before, you know, those kind of things. But also, I think on the flip side of that, as soon as you said that, I was thinking about you also get some freedoms that you might not necessarily have had. So I feel like they had the opportunity on that one to just, the record company said, hey, man, do whatever you want to. You know, you don't, well, I mean, maybe that's not exactly the case. Maybe the record company wanted them to keep making Rumors 2 and Rumors 3, you know, sort of over and over again.
I'm pretty sure the record company did. Yeah.
They probably always do that. But they, you know, they took that freedom, and Tusk is so cool because it's so sprawling, I think, in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of cool little things on there that probably you wouldn't have gotten away with on, you know, an album that didn't follow up such a massive seller.
Obviously, Lindsey was the driving force on that album, but Sarah is fantastic. But also Stevie with Beautiful Child is just, whew, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's a song. And Christine's got some good songs. Mm-hmm. And obviously some of Lindsay's songs are great. I mean, for me, the production on That's All for Everyone is first rate. And I would, again, I think this is one of those albums people might want to go back and have a listen to, and they may, because you just kind of skip over these things, especially with the double album, they can be a bit,
yep,
over bit by much.
Great point. I think it's a perfect time to dive into that. That would be a great, that'd be a great project. Yeah, absolutely. Listen to each side a few times.
Speaking of the Fleetwood Mac and Tusk, I think you're right, Patrick, to some extent, especially a band that already had some capital built up, like Fleetwood Mac, that,
yeah,
they basically could then, you know, spend it, right? So they're like, you know, we can call the shots a little bit more on what we do because we now have some power, mm-hmm, you know, and some real power. And that was funny. I remember reading an interview many years ago with Martin Scorsese where he said that same kind of thing. He was like, the way I deal with the movie studios is make one movie for them and then I'll make one,
yeah,
movie for me. And that's, you know, how we do it, right? So, like, I'll keep pumping out the mob movies for them.
Right.
But in between, I'm going to do the weird stuff that I want to do, right? You know. The other band that had a very similar experience right around this same, mm-hmm, time was The Clash. So London Calling was a big, you know, not to the same massive scale as Fleetwood Mac, but it was a breakthrough,
right,
album for them, right? And
yeah,
then
that's right,
after that was,
yes,
Sandinista, right?
Mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. Shooting those Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember the day and the days before the army came. Remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad. It was Washington bullets again.
Talk about sprawling, right? It's like,
well,
all over the place.
That's a great point. And you know, not only, you know, like Rumors, I think, not only sales-wise, but critically, suddenly they built up, you know, all this acclaim as well. And I think that probably plays,
yes,
into it, too.
Yeah, and the London Calling example, for,
yeah,
sure, they
totally
became deemed like a masterpiece, right? So,
And I'm looking here, and I knew somebody did this, and I was trying to figure out who it was. It was Camper Van Beethoven. I don't know if you're familiar with them, Mike. But they
yeah, you're going to talk about Tusk?
Yeah, they did a whole, I knew somebody had done a whole entire album cover of, you know, a song for song cover of an album. That could be a topic, another topic to explore one day. But I remember hearing it at,
yes,
one time. I got to go back and see if it's streamable or anything like that. But that's a fun idea. The one I wanted to talk about really was, you know, I think it's pretty well, you know, hidden, but obviously it's a classic. It's a Dead Ringer, Meatloaf's follow-up to Bat Out of Hell. No, just kidding. I was trying to figure out what was the follow-up to Bat Out of Hell, because that was such a massive selling album, and it didn't come till 4 years later. Let me see.
Were there any hits
Roy
on
Bittan
it?
Was the co-arranger from the E Street Band.
Wow.
He played a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, Dead Ringer for Love was the single. That was a duet with Cher. So no, I don't think anybody does.
I don't remember that.
But yeah, just looking here, it didn't do very well. It made number 45 on the US Billboard top 200 albums, but that's as high as it went. So it was pretty much a dud.
So the funny thing with Meatloaf, now that you're on this topic, is, well, actually, now the first thing I would encourage the listeners to do is go look
Ringer,
at this,
yeah,
cover
it's
art on this album. Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. That is the most over the top thing I've seen. But anyway, but then the funny thing with Meatloaf is
he did
later on, didn't, mm-hmm, he do a Bat Out of Hell 2? So he basically was,
no,
like, this is not going to work for me to try to follow up this hit with just some regular album. I got to basically,
yeah,
go,
exactly,
back,
and that
and
was
just
a
create
huge
a sequel,
album,
right?
The Bat Out of Hell 2, Back Into Hell,
right,
which came out in September of 1983. And then he made Bat Out of Hell 3. So, yeah. And I may have told this story once before, but I was covering Meatloaf at Wolf Trap, and he fell off the stage, unfortunately. He got a little too close to the edge while he was singing and just disappeared. And that wasn't good, but he was okay. He was all right. He finished the show.
He's okay. I'm okay.
No, the one I want to talk about was, to me, you know, and I understand that this was early in their career, but the Beastie Boys had License to Ill. And, you know, that was a huge, massive selling album. I don't know how many copies that thing sold, but it was big. And then they come back with Paul's Boutique after it, which is, you know, again, another totally sprawling, you know, dense album that it kind of was the album, I think, in some ways that, I don't know, ignited this whole thing about sampling and copywriting and, you know, because there's about 80 million samples on there that I don't think you could have gotten cleared any time after the 90s. But it's quite an amazing record. You know, the first one was a massive hit, but 3 years later, Paul's Boutique came around and just a total head trip that they really got into and created this world. It's my favorite Beastie Boys album.
Oh, yeah.
I looked out the window, seeing this bull head. Pulled out an egg, sculpted on my sculpt, he had no hair.
Lost that shot, he was caught out there.
Saw the convertible driving by, loaded up the slingshot, let one fly.
He went for his to find, he didn't have one, put him in shape, wreck my egg gun.
The egg, a symbol of life, a course that down to bust out to white.
I pulled out the gem, he thought it was a joke.
The trigger,
I pulled
his face,
the yolk.
Reached in his pocket, took all his cash,
left my man standing with the egg mustache.
Suckers, they come, a dime, a dozen.
Yeah, that's a good. That's a really good example. When you talk about a band that has a big hit and then uses that to do something like really creative, that's a prime example, right?
Yeah, the big long suite at the end, B-boy Bouillabaisse, with all those different little sections in it is just totally incredible. And you know, there's some tremendous songs on that record. But you know, you can go to the Wikipedia page and check out all the samples that were used for every tune, and it's pretty amazing. You know, it really is.
So here's the one I wanted to talk about. Back in 1984, a guy named Prince had a big hit album called Purple Rain, and I don't even know how many it sold, but it was a lot. And then, not even a year later, I just looked this up. It was like 9 or 10 months later, he released a follow up, which was Around the World in a Day.
It's a great album.
Did not sell nearly as well. I think it's still like double platinum or something. Like most other artists would love to have that kind of success, but compared to 13 or 15 million or whatever the previous album did, it was a big drop off. But I think Around the World in a Day is really amazing. I think that's another example of a guy who used the opportunity to, you know, do something really weird and creative. It's got all these, like, I mean, the title even says it. It's got all these weird, like, world music kind of flavors and elements to it. It did have a couple of hit songs. Mm-hmm. It has Raspberry Beret and it has Pop Life. But, you know, some of the other cool songs like Paisley Park and America is like really cool. I really like this record. I play it, you know, pretty regularly. It's probably, I don't know if it is my favorite Prince album, but it's definitely up there.
Tell you nowhere. You've taken a lifetime.
That actually was on my list as well. I think that is a, I think Around the World Today is a fantastic album. I agree with you, and the hits are great. And I was going to mention the song Paisley Park in particular. I think it's a really great sounding song.
The album kind of gets overlooked today because it came, not only did it come out after Purple Rain, but it was a couple albums later. Was Sign of the Times, which was then considered another sort of big, you know, masterpiece type album for Prince. So
Sign of the Times is probably my favorite Prince album. I don't know what I was thinking. And that is a masterpiece. And it did kind of overshadow it in a way, didn't it? Because, and plus, wasn't, what was the album after that? Was it Parade? Was it right after Around the World?
Mm-hmm.
Parade was too.
And those all have monster hits as well. So it's kind of like, there were so many right there because he was on a tear like nothing else.
Well, Parade had the song Kiss, which is a masterpiece of a song. So anyway, go listen around the World in a Day, people. If you don't know that album, it is a true album too. That's the other thing I really like about it. Even though it has a couple of big hit songs, it really bears listening to as a full album experience.
You know, thinking about what Mike said about them having hits and all that, Prince could almost do, you know, the song for the record company and then songs for himself on the same record and actually like make it work. You know, that's pretty amazing.
Oh, for sure.
Was that good. But yeah, so I guess, you know, like between 82 and 87, that's a pretty decent run with 1999 Purple Rain, Around the World in the Day, Parade, and Sign of the Times. It's not bad. It's not bad. All going platinum except for Around the World in a Day, according to the internets here. So that's pretty great. It is good. I haven't listened to it in a long time. I also love albums with when the artist's name is not on the cover. Like, I think that's so cool. It's always so intriguing to me when you see it. And you're like, what the? Who is? Like, I can't tell who this is. It's not on the spine either. Like, I love that. It's so great.
Not to get us off track here, we'll get back on track in a second, but I think Prince would be a good candidate for one of our top 15 countdown.
He definitely has the goods in order to be able to do it. Mm-hmm.
All right, some more of these examples, Mike.
The next one, I know this is, there's actually been some discussion around the boards lately about Pink Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think either one of you guys are big Floyd fans, but The Wall was obviously a monster hit. I don't know, it's because I was of the I remember when The Wall came out. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, I know Dark Side was a massive hit as well, but it didn't seem to permeate the culture as much as The Wall did, because there wasn't a big hit off of Dark Side. It just sort of went on and on forever. Mm-hmm. But you know, The Wall came out and had Brick in the Wall 2, which was the monster hit, right?
Yeah.
Tons of radio airplay, yeah, for sure.
I always thought the album after The Wall, The Final Cut, which is a controversial album amongst Floyd fans, is a fantastic album as well. It's really quiet. It's really introspective. It's a lot about Roger's father and losing his father, mm-hmm. and all that. And it's not, you know, the feel-good hit of the summer. But the album itself is really outstanding. I mean, the title cut alone, just, you could listen to the title cut alone just for David Gilmour's guitar solo. I mean, I know David Gilmour did like the album, but his that song and his solo is fantastic.
Would you sell your story to Rolling Stone? Would you take the children away and leave me? Smile in reassurance as you whisper down the phone. Would you send me packing? Or would you take me home?
And the album is really more about the lyrical content, and the music is kind of this, there to provide sort of a base for the lyrics, right? A lot of times we notice the music first, but that album is really, really about the lyrics.
I'm glad you brought that up, Mike. That's probably my favorite of the, you know, the what I call the later period. Well, I guess it's later period. I mean, I guess you could divide it up into a couple of things. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Syd Barrett era, Pink Floyd, and I like everything kind of up to Adam Hart Mother, and then I kind of get lukewarm on stuff. But I had a friend, Dave McChesney, who really loved this album, man. He used to play it all the time, and it is really intriguing. And once you get into it, it really kind of brings you into its spell. And I remember that it is very quiet. That's a great way to describe it. It's very subtle. It doesn't have those outrageous highs and lows of The Wall. And around the same time, or maybe, I don't know if it was around the same time or a year or two later or before, I'm not sure here, but Roger Waters put a solo album out called The Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking. And yes, we used to listen to those two together for whenever it was. And I think he had a cassette with The Final Cut on one side and Pros and Cons on the other side. 84, yes. Pros and Cons. So, yeah, those two we kind of got into together. And that was, yeah, kind of my last real dive into the Floyd. I never got into Division Bell or any of the other stuff that sort of came on later.
As a quick aside, the last two albums were okay. Mm-hmm. They're not, but there's some really outstanding songs on there. I don't think as a whole album they're nearly as strong. I mean, you know how delicate bands are, right?
Yeah.
That thing that makes them work. I mean, look, if I had an album as good as the Division Bell, I'd be like, hey, here,
right?
You know. But compared to, you know, Dark Side or Wish You Were Here. I mean, Wish You Were Here was actually a really difficult follow-up as well, mm-hmm. because they had, you know, for them at that time, they went from basically a very, very small band. Obviously, they had some success in the Syd Barrett years, but to go from that to stadiums like they did with, or at least arenas, I don't know if they did stadiums then, but obviously a much bigger band for that, you know, much bigger breakthrough for them. And Wish You Were Here is, I, now that I think about it, which I hadn't thought about it before, it's an amazing
follow-up
album.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking, too, at this list of greatest selling albums of all time, but it's kind of disappointing to me because I don't think greatest hits should count. But, you know, a lot of this is made up of greatest hits,
right.
Stuff, including the number one, which is a greatest hits album. But I, you know, I mean, I think you got to throw that out of there personally. So if you throw that out of there, the Wall is like number four, right up there with,
really?
Yeah. Cause number two, you have Thriller, then you have Hotel California, then you have Led Zeppelin IV, then you have The Wall.
Are you saying The Wall sold more than Dark Side of the Moon?
I think because it's a double, album, it counts for two.
But I don't. Dark Side is number 26 on this list, 15 million, where The Wall is 23. So, big difference. Yeah, it sold very steadily, but I don't think it sold in,
right,
tremendous hunks like The Wall did.
So one of the albums that must be on the top selling of all time is Michael Jackson's Thriller, correct? And I was just looking up to on that follow up. So, which the follow up was an album called Bad. 1987, and whereas Thriller sold looks like 33 million copies,
yeah,
exactly. Bad still sold like 10 million. So, you know, crazy successful. But it basically, I think in that case, he was just trying to make another Thriller. Like, I don't think there was an effort to go a different direction on that. It was just, give us more.
You know, an interesting thing, too, looking here is, and I hadn't thought about this, and I think it's such a great topic. I can feel myself getting pulled into this. But You know, another band whose debut album was a massive seller was Pearl Jam, like the Beastie Boys. 10 sold something like 13 million copies. And yes. then they came out with Verses in 1993, which still, again, to your point, sold 7 million, Jim. So, you know, not a slouch. It was a number one album as well. But I don't think, you know, I'm not a huge Pearl Jam fan, but what do you guys think about the comparison between those two?
So I'm more of a Pearl Jam fan than you are. And at that time, I was probably as much into them as I was other bands. Okay. That's just a continuation. That's another example of a continuation. It's not really... Mm-hmm. creatively Got that it. Different okay. from the debut album. Whereas maybe some of their later albums, you know, they try to explore some different territory, but I think those first two albums are really kind of like you can consider them almost a set.
Alone, listless, breakfast table in an otherwise empty room. Violins, center of her own attention. Mother reads aloud, child tries to understand it, tries to make her proud. The shades go down, it's in her hair. Painted room, can't deny something wrong. Don't call.
And I think that happens sometimes with the debuts, especially because maybe they already, you know, had some songs written from before, you know, so I don't know that many bands, you know, the Beastie Boys aside, I don't know that many bands that in their second album take like, a, you know, kind
right,
of a dramatic
right.
turn.
And that's one reason Paul's Boutique kind of jumped to my mind. But I mean, hey, look at Boston. That second album was basically a carbon copy of the first album, just not as good. Yeah,
that's right.
Oh, that's
there's a lot
right,
of stuff
yeah.
like that. I mean, you could say that with the Cars, you know, you could, yeah. I mean, it's good, yeah. but it's, you know, it's just kind of the same stuff. I think a band like Weezer is funny. You know, they were similar to the Beastie Boys in a way, in that way, in that Pinkerton was an album following that Blue album, which was huge. And then they came out with Pinkerton, which was really kind of like more artistically interesting. And a lot of the fans did not like it. But over time, yeah. it's become more critically acclaimed, right? Like, that's the
right.
that's the Weezer album you should get, is Pinkerton. Right, yeah. Like, that's the cool one, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
All the cool kids have that one.
Yeah, exactly.
yeah.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, look who's
oh,
here.
Oh, it's Shadow. Where'd he go? Oh, I miss Shadow. Just, that's the only thing. I need a virtual Shadow hug.
He ran through the room faster than I could move the camera. That.
All right. And what's Shadow's follow-up album? So.
Yeah, that's going to be hard to top.
Hopefully his second act will be more like sleeping and lying around the house. That's my
That's right.
That's my hope as he matures as an
artist. Or something heroic, rescuing a small child from a well or something like that.
Okay, any others?
I got one more that I had on my list.
Okay. Close us out.
The album So... by Peter Gabriel was obviously a massive hit because you had Sledgehammer and Big Time was fairly good. And obviously In Your Eyes was a massive hit off that album. And that album sort of permeated the culture, you know, it was really out there, you know, really a big album.
Really did.
And then it took him, I think So was released in 86 or so. And I think he did do some film work with Scorsese, I think for, one of his movies, I can't remember for sure, but his next official album that came out was an album called Us, which is actually one of my favorite albums, and I think actually for this time might be a little rough to listen to, but it's a really great album, and it doesn't follow up. I mean, it's Peter Gabriel; he's very good about, you know, switching directions a lot. But the songs on there are really outstanding. The lead track, "Come Talk to Me," mm-hmm. is really spectacular. And if you've ever seen, I would encourage folks to. I went and saw that tour, and it was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And it was really thematic, and it might be on YouTube, but you could at least find when he opens with "Come Talk to Me." I won't tell you about it, but it is just. Go if you I recommend going and watching the video. The song is outstanding, and there's a really fantastic song called "Washing of the Water," just a beautiful, beautiful song. And I would really encourage folks to investigate this album.
Washing of the water, make it all right. Let your waters reach me. Like she reached me tonight. Letting go, it's so hard. The way it's hurting now. To get this love untied. So tough to stay with this thing. Cause if I follow through, I face what I deny. I get those hooks out of me. And I take out the hooks that I sung.
Well, you have me intrigued here because honestly, I don't really know this album. So, let's see. This came out in 92. Yeah, I think it had the misfortune of coming out at a time when I was just way more interested mm-hmm. in like, you know, younger, newer artists. And so I probably didn't give it a fair shake. But now that I'm looking at the track list, so Steam was the big like hit single from it, right?
That is the one track. I don't know why he included that song because it just kind of doesn't fit on the album. Like the rest of the album flows perfectly, and then you get that song in there, it's like you can almost hear like somebody on the record company saying that's got to go on the album because that sounds like that's the only song that sounds like so.
That's right. And that's what I was going to say is I remember Steam, I remember there being another like crazy video for it, which was sort of so what was the sort of like a sledgehammer type video with a lot of special effects and things like that on Steam. So then I think when I saw that on MTV, I was kind of like, it's just another album. And I probably never gave it a shot. But now that I look at this, I'm seeing, I guess I didn't realize that Digging in the Dirt is on that album too. And I know that song, and that song sounds more like old Peter Gabriel to me.
It's a really intense album. I will say that. But there's also a warmth and a person coming to terms with a lot of stuff. It's a great headphone album, you know. I saw somebody post an article the other day. I can't remember who it was. Talking about deep listening to albums, and now we might be able to do that, right? Because we're always moving from thing to thing to thing, right? And this is one of those albums that it is my favorite Peter Gabriel album.
That's definitely something I would listen to. And I'll say too, that is one guy I've never seen in any form in concert and would love to have seen or see, because everybody, just like Mike says, you got to see it. Like, it's so incredible, the spectacle that he puts on and you know, the things he did. It's just amazing. So I've watched a few videos and things like that, but that would be somebody, you know. I hope he does another tour at some point. I would love to see him.
I saw him once, Patrick, in 1987, I want to say it was, in Rome, Italy.
Oh, you did? Oh, wow.
Yes. It was very cool. It was in an arena there. I think it was actually like the basketball arena where they had once had the Olympics when Rome had the Olympics. I don't know what year. I think in the 60s. But anyway, it was an incredible show. It was like really intense. You know, he really can like hold the audience. You know, yeah, it's really great. Cool. Great topic.
We can always have follow-up. You know, someone else can have a follow-up episode, and I'm sure folks can. Where can they post a comment on this, Jim?
Well, You could call. We'd love to hear your voice. 612-440-1984. There you go. Or email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those places at suburbspod. Also give a shout out. Go to our website, suburbspod.com, where Sam and Patrick do a great job maintaining that. And I have almost no involvement whatsoever. And so thank you for that, guys. And but lately we also have now a online store where people can buy merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
So go to the website, click on merch table, and you'll see t-shirts, pint glasses, bottle openers, and stickers for sale.
That is correct.
Delivered right to your home. So
that's right.
What you need. Everybody needs a pint glass right now, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
At least one. One in each hand.
Oh.
There you go.
And you have plenty of time to read the newsletter as well, don't you?
That's right. Thank you, Mike.
Please
you
do that.
We put a lot of work in that. And one of the great things that Jim got going for that newsletter I love very much is the Listener of the Week. And it's great to sort of, we spotlight the listeners with a series of questions. And it's really cool to learn about a little more detail about folks, what they do, and all those things. We need to have you on soon as a feature, Mr. Wagner.
Yep.
I hope to do that.
That might be a name. Not that guy again. Snacks. Swipe.
But, well, sweeps week. It'll be all Mike Wagner content. But you can go to our website, suburbspod.com. Thank you, Mike, for bringing that up, and click on the newsletter tab. It's free to subscribe. And just one more email, but it's thoroughly enjoyable. And put a lot of love into that thing. The interns are involved, and it's a lot of fun.
Yep. Very cool. Oh. And then go to patreon.com/suburbspod, and that's where you can get information on being a patron of the show, like that's Mike.
So, right.
And again, Mike, we, of course, appreciate your support. You've been one of our biggest supporters over the years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't be where we are without Mike.
All right. Thanks, guys. I think we're going to just, you know, keep recording, right, Patrick? We're going to keep this train moving.
That's right. That's what we're going to do.
All right.
As I have said, as long as I'm semi-conscious, I will be here recording. So.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you very much. That was really, really fun.
Thank you, Mike. All right. So to all the listeners out there, it's Rock in the Suburbs, and I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Mike Wagner.
And we'll talk to everyone later. That was kind of a big deal.